हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Page 67. Worshipping the demigods as independent of Krishna. Haridas spoke with folded hands. Now hear about the second offense, O Lord of the universe. Vishnu is the supreme principle, not subject to the duality of the material world. He is a form full of consciousness and knowledge, existing eternally beyond the modes of material nature. Although being the absolute controller of the material world, Krishna in Goloka is the origin and supreme Vishnu form, being ornamented with 64 transcendental qualities to enhance his blissful activities by which he performs his activities. The Purusha avatars and other plenary avatars all possess these 60 qualities in order to carry out their function. So establishing Krishna's position as beyond everything, supreme principle, that means everything is based on him, right? So this supremacy and all that, then, so you're getting this, this position, the form full of consciousness and knowledge existing beyond the modes of nature, right? So full of consciousness and knowledge existing and, how you say, the supreme blissful activity. So you're dealing with Satchidananda here, right? So his position is there, but you see it's always balanced with that personal touch, that personal interactiveness, that personal element. So being God for him is just who he is. But that's not in his mind in the important element. You know, it's just like you have, Prabhupada gives the example, you have your high court judge or not, your big personality. So that has meaning, that's what his position is in society. It's just a fact, right? He's the prime minister. It's just a fact. But in his relationship with his family, being the prime minister is not an important element. You know what I'm saying? You know, the family relating to the rest of the world, okay. But his relationship in the family has nothing to do with it. Right? His 3-year-old grandchild is telling, is riding around on his back playing horsey, right? And telling him go here, go there and all that. So that's because the little kid's thinking, yeah, I'm 3 years old, you know, and I got this 60-year-old guy, you know, taking me around the house. He's the prime minister, so what does that make me? Is that what he's thinking? No, not at all. For the kid, it's simply, here's his grandfather, and he's interacting. That's all. So, for Krishna, these points are made that he is God. So we understand that, because otherwise we have a slight confusion in thinking that we're in the post, right? Not subject to supreme principle, of course, that's what we like. Not subject to the duality of the material world. That's a problem, because generally we're the one creating the duality, let alone being subject. He is a form full of consciousness and knowledge, that's lacking, existing eternally beyond the modes of nature, that's definitely not there. Although being the absolute control of the material world, it is a something we're looking forward to, but we don't have. Right? But it's establishing, but for Krishna, he's the original form, 64 qualities, right, that enhances blissful activities. Right? So, That is the thing. The plenary purushavatars, they have the 60 qualities. They carry out the functions of the world. Right? And so the functions of the world being carried out, this element of just being Godhead, is only important to maintain the material creation where we look at it in a separate way. Right? In other words, if the living entities are dynamically interactive with God on the platform of love, then there is no need of Purusha avatars who are just acting as God. Because you have to act as God if someone else thinks you're God. Just like, let's say you're a very powerful person, and someone who's very small comes up to you with attitude, is talking big and this and that, then to get things done, you actually have to tell them how it's actually working. You know, it's not a matter of, oh no, make it nice for them or be supportive and that. Say, no, it's wrong. You know what I'm saying? So you just have to tell them what it is. So the Purusha avatars, then that's their mood because that's how we deal with them. Right? It's either we're God, or if we accept God, then He's going to supply everything we want. And okay, it's natural since we're working on an economic principle here. I want something, I have to do something for it, so I'll be good, He fulfills all my needs. Right? And that's the relationship, and that's a good one. Right? Basically you have, you know, you could probably say 6 billion people on the planet who work on that one, if they're religious. Right? So, the difficulty comes is, but what is interesting to him is the personal aspect. Right? But, in this verse, because it's, the demigods are not in, we have to establish his position. So even though we talk all these nice, sweet things, still, he's God, and so when it comes to dealing with things on that level of who's the absolute controller, whose existence, you know, whose consciousness, knowledge, then it's him. No one else is going to come up to that. Krishna expands as two types of conscious particles. The first is the ordinary jiva, who has 50 qualities to some degree. This is Haridas Thakur. Lord Brahma is talking here. And so he's talking about here, you know, and he is somebody who, you know, is kind of like omnipresent, omniscient, and these things to some degree. First is the ordinary jiva, right, who has 50 qualities to some degree. The second are the demigods, who have the same 50 qualities, but to a greater degree. In addition, Shiva possesses 5 more qualities. Vishnu has all these qualities, plus 5 more, that are not found in other living entities. In this way, we can see that Vishnu, or Narayana, with 60 qualities, is the Lord, and Shiva and the demigods are his servants. Greater than the ordinary jivas are the demigods and Shiva, and greater than Shiva is Vishnu, who is the Lord of the jivas and the Lord of the demigods. Therefore, whoever considers Vishnu on the same level as the demigods is ignorant. Because those 5 qualities, they cannot have. Right? 50 qualities are common. So out of 64, 50 is common. Right? I think that's what, 78%. I think was that. So if you have a relationship with someone that 78% is common, that's considered good. Right? If you're doing compatibility in charts, some will consider if it's 50% compatible, then that's okay, it's workable. So 78% is good. Right? So that's the basis. One doesn't have to have more, but that's just the way it is. Right? So here we've made the ordinary jivas who have it to some degree. Demigods have the same qualities to a greater degree. Right? But it's still just the same 50. Shiva has 5 more. Right? To some degree. But Vishnu has those full, and then beyond that another 5. And then Krishna has beyond that another 4. Some people claim that the Brahman, without qualities, takes on qualities when it expands as Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. However, the conclusion of scripture is that Narayan is supreme and is the cause of Brahma and Shiva. Whoever rejects Vishnu as the supreme controller and takes to the worship of demigods falls into the world of illusion. Right? So that's why we say the Mayavadis, besides seeing everything of Maya, they're also in Maya. Right? Because generally if they do worship, they always worship Shiva. Shiva, Shakti, They have deities. They do the full worship and everything like that. Like in Guruvayur, that worship was established by Shankaracharya. Some say the worship in Puri was done by Shankaracharya. Like that. So they worship, but they tend to worship demigods. Like that. So here, Brahman without qualities takes on qualities, but the thing is how could Brahman take on qualities unless that quality to be able to take on qualities was there? Right? So if Brahman has no qualities, that means it doesn't have the quality to take on qualities. Right? So that it can take it on means it's inherent. You know what I'm saying? Other people claim that since Vishnu is all-pervading throughout the universe and is present in the demigods as well, one can worship Vishnu by worshipping all the demigods. But this is not the ruling of the scriptures. Rather, this type of activity is forbidden. By worshipping Vishnu, all other worship is perfected. Just as by giving water to the root of the tree, the branches become satisfied. By worshipping Vishnu exclusively, all worship is covered. This is the Vedic conclusion. But unfortunately, the fools reject this precept. Because it's saying if he's everywhere, then you can worship the demigod. But they're not worshiping that the Lord is his potency in the demigod, and they're worshiping that. They're worshiping the person themselves, another ordinary jiva, who is in a more powerful position. You understand? So it's very nice to say everything is God, and that therefore I can do whatever I want with anything, and I'm interacting with God. No, the point, if you're not recognizing God, and it doesn't matter. You know what I'm saying? That's the point. You can't be in a situation and say, you know, the Lord is all those things and then interact with all those things not in relationship to the Lord. Right? And then think that it's something spiritual. Right? If you're relating to the situation in connection with the Lord, then that which you are relating to the Lord, that becomes spiritual. So that argument doesn't work. Under the influence of Mayavadi philosophy, the living entities of Kali Yuga put Vishnu on the same level as the demigods. In truth, however, the demigods give only limited result, whereas worship of Vishnu yields all results. Because everything is there. But we want it to come in our way. Therefore, we'll say it doesn't give all results. Right? Means if you worship Krishna, right, that means artha comes from dharma. Right? So if you're performing dharma, which is sanatana dharma, so that means all arthas or all things to gain will come from that. Right? And since the Lord is his energy, which is Lakshmi. Opulences are his energy. Therefore, then, just by worshipping him, whatever opulence is going to be there will come. But we have a separate idea. Right? We try to make our own arrangements that are not based on authority, based on Shastra. Right? Like Shastra says, the Grihastha has an occupation. That's where it comes from. God gave the concept that Grihasthas have occupations. Right? It's not anywhere else. Any community of the world, technically speaking, occupation is considered a Grihastha's, you know, duty. Right? Does that make sense? It means even today, if you have the, you know, 40-year-old bachelor, he's a lawyer, he's wealthy, he lives in a big house with his mother, you know, and all that, people will think it's strange. He's not married. Why not? Why is he 40, so wealthy, so qualified, why is he not married? Yes, Maya something. He's not willing to commit himself to, so they'll think it's there. So he's got all this money in that, but he's got his Porsche, he's got his big mansion, you know, he has his part, but will anybody really consider that it's successful materially? On one level, yes, but what's the meaning? It's like, you know, the little kid is, you know, the you know, 3-year-old kid is wearing a $200,000 diamond necklace. So you'll say, wow, what a successful kid. You'll say, what is the kid doing with that necklace? You know what I'm saying? That's the point. You know, it doesn't match. So grihastha ashram, having an occupation, that's created by God. Does that make sense? So that's the point. Krishna's not married, but he's taking out whose cows? His father's cows. Right? He's not an independent bachelor that it's his own cows. That's weird. But the son is working for the father, or assisting the father. That's normal. You understand? Or we see, like Bhaktivinod Thakur, you know, so many examples is that, you know, his father dies, grandfather dies, and so it's just him and his mother and unmarried sister. So at 12 he goes, takes them, goes to Calcutta and gets a job. That will be normal. Right? I mean, it's extreme, but it's normal. Why? Because he's taking care of women. But if he just left and went to Calcutta and got a job, okay, then that's a nice inspiring story for a guy who's gonna, you know, get ahead in the world and this and that. But you don't think of it socially. You only think of it economically. But this example, you think of it socially. You know, he has such responsibility at 12, he's going, he's getting work, he's taking care. Does that make sense? So all this is to bring out the point that this concept is universal. Why? Because it's created by God. So now if it's created by God, then why is it that God's systems for being economically viable, those aren't good? Why is it that we'll make our own systems up? Our own ideas. No, only by being God conscious and performing your duties, then it's there. But the duty is to do those things. Your duty is to have a job, an occupation. That is your duty. But if it's your duty, then we don't want to do it. But if it's like my own desire, then it's okay. So this is what I'm saying, is that it's not understood. So when we're saying this point, is that the worship under the influence of my, we give up this idea. No, I'm going to do it. Spiritual is another thing. Right? So I'm going to be successful material and take care of my family. That's one thing. Then devotional life is another thing. That is directly Mayavad philosophy. Because that means this world is not all God. Right? It's not that everything is God. Everything here working is because of God and His laws and His energies. So only if you follow them will you be successful. No, it's that there's God. He's somewhere else. This world is separate from Him. And therefore, I'm the Lord and Master of this. And by my doing good work, I'm going to get the result. This is a pretty standard philosophy. And if you talk to most people, this is what they speak. Right? And no, you're not talking to karmis. Okay? But this is straight Rega philosophy. I mean, one sense I almost quoted here from Hamilton, who was the one who established the American economic system. Like that. It's one of the founding fathers of America. This is pretty standard stuff all over the world. You know what I'm saying? Is that you deify God and the spiritual master and spirituality and put it in its own category. You know, like that. So, and then we're the lords of this creation, and we go about, you know, doing whatever we need to do that's practical and gets the results. But that's Mayavad philosophy. You know, it's also mixed very heavily with karma. You know, that we think that I'm the controller and enjoyer, so I'll do this work and I'll get that. But this idea that there's a separation, that's impersonalism. Right. Does that make sense? So these things is that we'll look at this and okay, yeah, no, we don't think we know Krishna is separate from the demigods, but do we? Okay, we're not worshiping Brahma and Shiva and that, but what about all those, you know, success gurus and management gurus and all that? What about them? For the Westerner, that's their demigods. You know, if you're into success. If you're not, of course, it's going to be some other celebrity that, you know, sings or dances or acts, you know, or looks good in a bathing suit, You know, like that. Does that make sense? So these are the Western, like that. Is that the yes?
From Asia, except to, if you don't follow Sanatana Dharma, we just have inside this worshiping.
Yeah. Yeah. It means you have Sanatana Dharma or you have duality or Maya. These are the only options. You know? Yes.
Classic impersonalism, isn't it more like there's no qualities to God, there's no personality to God?
Yes, so that means I'm going to work, and I'm going to read Covey, and I'm going to figure out how work works so I'll get more money. Where was God there? That's classic. The point is we're just not understanding the change in vocabulary. This is the point. So classic Mayavadi, something else. And we're not Mayavadis, we're not atheists. Why aren't devotees following Varnashram? Theists follow Varnashram. Tribals or atheists don't. Buddhists don't follow Varnashram. Why? Because it's Vedic. They're called atheists. We're just discussing philosophy. This is not a cultural thing. This is just philosophy. But we have to know where these things come from. If devotees discuss about culture, they only discuss who's in control and who has the money. They don't discuss what are your God-given duties, what are your rights, and what are your obligations. And liberation, sense gratification, and devotion aren't part of the discussion. Right? So it means dharma, kama, moksha, and bhakti aren't part of the discussion. Bhakti will have a, you know, guest appearance, but all that's being discussed is artha. But if you discuss artha without dharma, how are you going to get it? You understand? Like that. It's just science. It's not a matter of opinion or feelings or it's just science. Hardcore science. Not soft science. This is not a sense. This is hard science. Like that. But the problem is until that's accepted, how one will work. So it's not a matter of this and that. It's a matter of if someone's sick, right? You have the big guy, you know, he's good at things and he's got his, you know, attitude, but, you know, it's okay. He does good. And he gets sick and everyone's telling him, you know, you got to slow down. You know, you're not young anymore. And then, oh, no, all that. So will he get any better? No, never. So where does him getting better start? By recognizing he's sick. So until that's recognized, then socially one can't function. You know? I mean, I wouldn't mind if the devotees were materially successful. They had tons of money and families and this and that and weren't always, you know, niggling about these things. But they're not. You know, and the worst part is the ones that are successful are either not knowingly or unknowingly following them. And they're the ones that definitely the Westerners won't follow. You know, you're not going to take any example from, you know, the Oriental class. You know what I'm saying? And here we're starting the Orient from, you know, the Middle East, like that. We could start it from Calais, right? That's where the British, that's where they say, you know, or the Orient starts. You know, others will put it at, what is it? The one in Bulgaria? The one very far to the west, Sofia? Or what's the one? Where is that one where the college professor, he was the temple president? And,
Timisoara.
Yeah, that one's like it made like a small Paris. And so some say it starts from there. You know, so different opinions. Does that make sense? So it's actually real. And if we accept it, then the point is the reason that the laws of nature work is because God said so, not because somebody observed them, and now it's their theory. So the point is it's nice, you can take from them, but if you take from them and don't add God to it, it's still just as atheistic. And the point is if you're working with a mundane principle, if you don't have the material karma to be successful at it, you won't be. You know what I'm saying? The person who's complaining about money and that, if he wasn't a devotee, where would he be situated in the Western culture? He wouldn't have any more position or facility than he does now. He wouldn't. You know what I'm saying? You know, big swami, big preacher, big this, he bloops, he's pumping gasoline. Because that's what he'd be doing if he wasn't a devotee. It's that simple. And now suddenly because we're devotees, now we have to have all facility. No, it's just whatever it is. The only way it'll be more is if it's coming by Krishna's grace. And that comes by pleasing Krishna. It's that simple. One may say it's very simplistic, but sorry. God, Vishnu is the supreme principle. That means everything you're dealing with, he's actually the supreme element in it. Not subject to the duality, you know, beyond the modes of nature. So if we're talking about things that are duality and the modes of nature and illusion, we can't call that substance, and we can't call that real, and we can't even call it practical, because it's not working. If it worked, you could say, okay, we can let it slide. But every time you hear the word, we're just being practical, Prabhu, it's just on the brink of some disaster going to happen. You know, something socially, economically, and this and that. They were just being practical, so they didn't deal with the devotees nicely. Because they just had to get the work done for Krishna. Right? So the point is it didn't work. You know? They got through the day, the festival happened, but then for the next, 20 years, people grumble about it. So it wasn't practical. But it's what worked for their consciousness at the time. Does that make sense? So it's not that this thing doesn't have relevance. You know what I'm saying? Because otherwise this is something we go through every day, right? Consider the demigods, like that. That's it. And like that. We do it every day. But the point is the significance is... Mm-hmm. Under the influence, if the materialist can understand this truth, they will take to Vishnu worship and achieve all results. When they say all results, we mean, of course, ultimately, Krishna consciousness, going back to Godhead. All results, we mean even material. You want to have a great time with your wife, it's only going to happen because of your worship of Vishnu. You want to interact nicely, you want her to be pleasant and nice. Why would she be pleasant and nice if you're a materialist? Unless you're damn good at it, and how long will that keep her occupied? So unless you're a devotee, devotees are the only ones that can please people all the time. So even if you just want a regular, pleasant, grihastha experience, you're not going to get it other than worship of Vishnu. It's that simple. When it says all results, it means all. Economically, sense gratification, liberation, devotion. It's only going to happen because of worship of Vishnu. That's it. That's you saying. If the materialist can understand this truth, they will take to Vishnu worship and achieve all results. Right? But we'll take to Vishnu worship just for the things that will acquiesce as spiritual. Right? The Bhagavatam starts off by pointing out everything's spiritual. There is no material. Material is your consciousness. Right? There's inferior energy, superior energy. But what we call material, that's only your consciousness. There is no such thing as material. It's an illusion that it exists. But that illusion, that illusion itself exists. But the point is being in that illusion, you don't actually know what's real. Right? Everything is Krishna and his potency. So there is no such thing as a situation which is not directly Krishna conscious. Like that. When they say all, they mean it. It's not, that's, that will come up in the later one to take it as an exaggeration. That's what it's meant there. When we say all, the devotees say, oh, that's nice for that, but in here we have to be practical materially. That means that's the sixth offense to the holy name. Because we take it as an exaggeration. Does that make sense? How should a householder in the Varnashram system act? Generally, he should give up worrying about inferior obligations and simply worship Krishna. In other words, in all the samskaras, from insemination to funeral rites, Krishna should be worshipped, using appropriate mantras from the Vedas. One should worship the Vaishnavas and Vishnu directly, and worship the forefathers by giving them prasad from Vishnu. Right? So everything was done materially. But it's all done in connection to Vishnu. Right? The worship of Krishna is an essential part of the Varnashram system. The four Varnas carry out life according to the rules of their particular caste, but do not worship Krishna, then they simply go to hell. So this just being practical, Prabhu, then that's just a few doors down. Particularly the Grihastha must follow the rules of his Varna in performing his worldly activities of raising family and relating with the rest of society. But at the same time, according to his means, he must worship Krishna. Very practical. Right? Particularly, Grihastha must follow the rules of his Varna. And Varna means occupation. So they're saying, yeah, get a job. That's what Krishna is saying. But do it in connection with Krishna. You know, this idea is, no, Krishna means, no, no. He said, the best would be just to worship Krishna. Generally, you should give up worrying about inferior obligations and simply worship Krishna. But if you're worried about money, facility, then that's inferior obligations. Then you do consider them in connection with the Lord. That's the meaning of it. Right? Like that. So anything below that that doesn't connect nicely to the Lord, which is Shastra's gift, then we don't have to worry about it. We're not obliged. You don't have to worship the forefathers by all the rules and regs. You just offer them prasad. That's it. That's simple. Like you sit down, you've offered to Krishna, or you offer to them. Done. Because as we explained, Manu devotes one full chapter out of 12 to just how to worship the forefathers. Like that. And it would be rare that there's a person who can actually do it right. It's so detailed. Right, so that's all it is. The samskaras are done with proper Vedic mantras that are in connection with Vishnu. Right? Like that. So it's all done, it's all simple. It's not complicated. So the samskaras are what, you know, Haridas Thakur is talking about, is the favorable Krishna conscious lifestyle. It's not a matter of discussion or question. No, he's saying is that you worship doing all these other things not directly in connecting with the Lord. That's to be given up.
No. So what about a devotee who has no real education but receive help from government?
He receives help from the government. Okay, but then what does he do with his time? You know what I'm saying? If you're receiving help from the government, then you're not actually working. So now, that would mean you don't have to work. Right? So that means he could do full-time service. So if someone's doing that, that's not a problem. Because the point is it also mentions that Manu mentions that if a Brahmin is having difficulty maintaining himself, then the king can maintain him, make arrangements to maintain him. And then the king gets 1/6 of all his pious grace. So if they're taking from the money from the government. So that means 1/6 of all their, you know, benefits of chanting, doing devotional service, 1/6 goes to the government. So you could say that they're doing very nice, giving so much pious credit to the government. But the point is if they're not doing devotional activities, then that's not good. No. point is that if the government is fully supporting, that means one has to be fully engaged in devotional activities, because it's only the brahminical class that can have, or shudras. But then you have to work for the government. So either working for the government or fully time doing service, one or the other. Those are lawful. Anything else, if you're getting paid by the government and still don't do service, then that's improper. Right? One will have problems in the future. Is that the sense? Yeah. So it's not a problem if they do full-time service. Or what they can. But full-time means what they would be putting into their occupation, not they're putting into devotional endeavor. You know what I'm saying? You go to work for 8 hours a day, so they should be doing service for 8 hours. And then, their family, their sadhana, and these other aspects. So it's not a wrong thing. But the government gets 1/6. Which is, fair enough.
Is it okay if a full-time devotee is doing service for the temple and maintained by the temple as a king and maintaining the temple?
Yeah.
Because some devotees, they're saying that Prabhupada, he didn't want that the devotees would pay for their service, that they should be for free.
The point is free means what? What does free mean? Is it free that the guy comes in and because he's been around in the yatra for 20 years, therefore he gets to sit there? That's not free. That means he distributed books all those years and now he's pulling rank that I did all this and I built the temple and I did this and I did that. And so therefore now I get to sit here. That's called business. You know what I'm saying? Free means it doesn't cost anything. You get no benefit from it. But that also means the people who are saying that get no benefit either. That means the temple authorities get no benefit. You go out, you do all that service, and then they're paid by the temple? You know what I'm saying? The person who can say that is someone who's doing full-time service and is not being paid by the temple. So that means no temple authority can ever let that fall out of their mouth. I'm saying, reality is reality. We don't like it. That's the sorry thing of the modern society, is truth, though they always talk about truth and like that. They actually do not like truth. The only point of truth is that the more I know about people, the more I can control. That's the point about it. So it's not actually truth, it's facts. Truth is another thing. Truth is God. Does that make sense? No, if the temple takes care, it means who was taking care of the devotees living in all the temples through the 60s and 70s? Who was taking care? The temple was. But the point is if you want security, you want this and that, your wife's pregnant, so you want to know what is there for emergency if this has to happen and they have to go to a hospital, then you got a problem. Then go out and get it yourself. But if whatever it is, you're there in the temple, and whatever comes up, and whatever they can take care of, then that's what you got, then that's fine. But if you want more than that, that the temple's not supposed to pay for. That you have your own nice apartment and the rent, and you got to have this, and phone, and internet, and you want dental, and you want other insurance, and all that, they don't have to pay for. That you go out and get yourself. Because there's very few people that are performing that much service that it's worth paying them that much. You know what I'm saying? If they're doing that much service, hey, take care. But it's in proportion to what they're doing. You're performing managerially, economically, you have more facility. You're not, you don't. You know what I'm saying? You get paid in what you work in. You know what I'm saying? The guy who's the head cook and full-time cooking and all that, and if he gets a few extra sweets on the side, is anybody going to complain? Not really. So therefore, the guy who is collecting all the money and that, if he has a little more facility, is there something to complain about?
It depends.
But the point is he's good at money. Why is he good at money? He likes money. So therefore, if he doesn't have any facilities, will he work? No. The guy who, or let's give a better example, the guy who cooks He's big, and he likes to eat, and he eats a lot. Okay? And he cooks everything and makes nice for everybody. Do you mind that he eats so much? No. Are you going to say, well, I'm, you know, very petite, and I eat only this much. I only eat 2 chapatis. So why is it he, just because he's the head cook, he gets to eat 10 chapatis? Why should he eat 10 chapatis? Would that be proper? No. So then the point is, the guy who collects the money, he gets more facilities. That's the way it is. You don't like it, then look in the mirror and check out the word called envy. That's it. So why would you be worried? If you were a pure soul, why would you care he has more money? But you don't. You do care. Why? Because you're envious. If you were jealous... Why I didn't use the word jealous? Because if you were jealous, you'd think, he has so much, and he's working hard. I will also work hard. I'll also get that much. That's jealous. Envious, he's working, he's getting that. I'm not getting that. He shouldn't get that. There's a difference. That's why envy is destructive. That's the mode of ignorance. And jealousy is the mode of passion. You'll get up and do something. He did that. I'm going to do that. Hey, they read out his name as the top books. I'm going to do that. That's jealousy. It works. But envy is absolutely useless. So your modern politically correct society is based on envy, not jealousy. You know what I'm saying? Jealousy is, their company's doing well, we're going to do well. Envy is where they're doing, we have to break that down. No, everybody's got to live at this poor level. Like that. But if everybody's having, but the poor level's fine, why anyone's talking about money? Then there's plenty of money. No, it's because people want more facility, but they don't have it. But then, like I said, do you deserve it? Materially, would you deserve it? If you were a karmi, what money would you have? What would you be doing? Not what you think you would be doing in reality. Does that make sense? So it's reality is stark. But the point is, unless we can adjust with reality, there is no such thing as social interaction. It's based on position. The guy is more powerful. That's why he's in charge. The guy is better at money. That's why he has more of it. The guy is, you know, socially more nice than that. That's why everyone likes him. It's just, that's the way it works. That's why it's said they're inferior. Because they're a distraction from Krishna. But the point is the Shastra already accommodates how to connect all those to Krishna. Because what are people fighting over? Right? Wealth. Right? Power. Renunciation. Knowledge. Influence. Well, no, we already mentioned that. Power is influence. Wealth, I mean beauty. And what's the last one?
Fame,
right? That's all. Oh, how can he be so big? Everybody knows him. This is dangerous to our society. What happens if he falls down? Right? We got to clean up the mess, as if you cleaned up any of the messes. You know what I'm saying? Devotees still don't know what's initiation. We've heard a lot about reinitiation, but has anybody actually heard what initiation is? You know, in other words, if I can't fry the beans, how can I refry them? You know what I'm saying? You know, we don't even know what beans are. Yeah, they're making great refried beans here. You know, it's like, it's not going to happen. You know what I'm saying? So, what mess was cleaned up? I don't see it. People have done some little, you know, this and that for the moment. That's good for 3 months, 6 months. But no mess has been cleaned up. Because you have to know what the mess is to be able to clean it up. If you don't know what garbage is, you can't clean it up. You know? Yeah, but don't get critical here. We're discussing the philosophy. Don't drop it into the social thing. The point is that philosophically here is we're dealing, if it's connected to the Lord, it has value. It's not connected to the Lord, even though it's expertly done materially, it still has no value. That's what we mean when we say that the materialist has no good qualities. We mean it. Because all this manifests is through the modes of nature. They're taking on and manifesting those qualities, but it's not theirs. Because you come back after some more time, they don't have those qualities anymore. Because it was just the modes. So when we say the materialists have no good qualities, we mean they don't. They may be manifesting a good quality, but they don't have it. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You know, the bank manager is walking with a briefcase, you know, full of, millions of dollars, but it's not his. So he walked by. Wow, he's wealthy. He's not. So the point is on the material platform, no one has any good qualities because whatever's manifest is simply due to the modes. Now the mode of goodness is coming up. You see something, you know, honorable. But, you know, after the mode of passion, mode of ignorance will come up, you won't see it. So it's not real. You understand? So the point is ultimately, if one understands this, then it doesn't matter what position one's in, what one is doing, or what one has done. Simply by taking up the Krishna conscious process, the association of devotees, one will move forward. History does not matter. Right? But because we give value to something other than Krishna, then we can't move forward. Because in 1973, this temple president did this to me. You know, it's what? 40 years later. And we can't move on. That's illusion. The point is the name is so powerful that one chanting removes all that. Right? And devotees chant, you know, you have one name, and there's 16 names in one mantra, and 108 mantras, and then that times 16. So that's a lot of mantras. What's it? 1728. And we know that because we're good at math or because we use clickers. Right? Right? But the point is that's a lot of... So that's mantras. And then that times 16 would be how many words are used. So that means that many times a day, they get freed from all sin. You know? So that's also, when we say it's not imagination, we mean it. Does that make sense? So the point is we find these points, but it's just to be able to discern the difference between pure devotional service and what's not pure. It's not for fault finding or criticizing. Or does that make sense? That's what you're saying, though. Particularly, the grihastha must follow the rules of his varna in performing his worldly activities of raising family and relating with the rest of society. But at the same time, according to his means, he must worship Krishna. Right? He must relate according to the varnasha. It's the only thing that tells you how to relate. Nothing else actually tells you how to relate. Maybe if you came from a family that had very good social skills, then you might have a little bit more of an understanding. But otherwise, you know, unless someone told you, how do you know? And he must respect and follow these rules as long as he has not come to the platform where the rules hamper his progress in worshipping Krishna. Right? And as we see, that's generally, you know, quite advanced. You know, they seem to start getting their way, you know, at Ruchi. Like that. So if one's not up to that thing, then one follows them. Right? So in other words, for management, one doesn't say that, oh, we're beyond the rules. Or for economics, you don't say we're beyond the rules. This is the platform technically known as Bhava. Okay, now here he gives it very specific. I was being very kind to say it starts there. But that means until you get to Bhava, you follow the rules. That's all. It's that simple. In that state, the jiva develops sadhana bhakti, in which the inspiration to perform devotional activities comes directly from the taste experienced by the pure jiva. This goal will eventually be achieved by the Grihastha Vaishnava, who accepts Vishnu as supreme. Right? Eventually. That's the point, is by following it, even as a Grihastha, one engages everything connected to the Lord. So that means body, mind, and words are connected to the Lord, even though it's through one's material, what do you say here, worldly activities of raising family and relating to the rest of the society. It's still, by connecting it to Krishna, brings you to that point of bhava. Because by doing it, you'll get liberated. Bhava starts at liberation. So the cultivation of the direct elements of sadhana, that will give you that taste, that is what is the principle of functioning at the level of bhava. But by engaging one's conditioned nature in the Lord's service, that will liberate you. You understand? So that combination is good. If it's only taste, but you're not pulling out of material nature, then you won't actually get to bhava, right? Does that make sense? And if you only liberate yourself but don't have a taste, then also you'll have a problem. Right? So the two go together. And he's also saying develop sadhana bhakti, which also, because this is Haridas Thakur, at the end of the book, it doesn't come in here, right? He's going to talk about bhav sadhana, right? But that's not the study here. Right? Yeah, it's not here. So the point is, so for him to call it sadhana, that's fine, because he's going to define it that way. He's going to spend a whole chapter discussing it. There is one other offense derived from not accepting Vishnu as the supreme, one without a second, or Advaya Tattva. Being the Advaya Tattva, Vishnu, by his inconceivable energies, possesses inherently name, form, and qualities, which cannot be considered separate from him. To consider name, etc., as different from the Lord is to consider the Lord and the name on a material level, right? Because there's duality, right? You know, we talk, the Lord is non-dual. We're not talking impersonal here. We just mean him and his creation are non-different. There is no duality.
This second offense is sometimes, especially a great Bhaktivinoda Thakur, paraphrased as this other offense, as you write here. That
this one.
To give mundane, to consider Pali name in like mundane framework.
That's also, you have to see is how you're putting it together. Because whether you're putting inattentiveness as one of the offenses or not. Because if so, then you generally see the interpretation or imagination, those are either merged or put into others. Right? It means that they're still there. It's just a matter of how you're going to define. In other words, if you have more space, then you give more detail. Like if you have 24 elements, then you break everything down. But if you're only talking, like Lord Brahma talks, 9 elements, then that means then you all the things that are connected to each other go together. Right? The mind and the senses, sense objects, and and the sense itself, right there, that's 16. Right? Does that make sense? So you can take that and call that one. Right? And if you count in the working senses, then that's another. So 20 of them become one. So simply if you say, talk about the mind being under the control of the three modes of nature, you're talking about the 24 elements. But we'll just take it, we always hear that. But that's what it means. Because the mind means all 20. Is that, yes?
I thought the non-dual substance is Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Why would Krishna say my separated energy or everything is in me, but I am not in everything? That you're saying that...
Because he as Bhagavan is not in everything. But he is Brahman is in everything.
But the separated energy?
Separated means... That's pointing out the element of consciousness. But it's still Krishna's energy, so we're functioning because of our connection with the Lord. The leaves still function because of the connection with the root.
So you're calling it non-dual?
Well, and haven't you seen Prabhupada use the term, the Lord is non-dual? He uses that all the time. Because we take it that he's dual, that him and his name or him and the world are different. That will be the mundane concept, because here the word rock and the rock are different. The Krishna's name are non-different. So he's non-dual. This is dual. So when you're discussing material, that's duality. And spiritual is non-dual. But it doesn't mean that spiritual doesn't have variety. See, because we accept Saguna Brahman. What the Mayavadis are talking about is Nirguna Brahman. No qualities. But for us, the Brahman is simply the effulgence is manifesting means the glory of Krishna's unlimited qualities is manifest as the effulgence, as the Brahman, which is all pervading. That means his qualities pervade into everything. So that's why whatever it is that you attribute to something, like this, you know, softness of the, well, let's not use that one. Let's say, you know, the warmthness of the blanket. Right? But warmth, that's Krishna. That's Krishna's quality. That's Brahman. Right?
Isn't the simultaneously one and different?
Yeah, but that means it's non-dual. You know what I'm saying? Because you're emphasizing on the difference, not on the sameness. But when the topic's talking about sameness, then we're talking about sameness. If it's simultaneously one and different, that means it is one. It can be one and different at the same time, but you're looking at it from the philosophical point of dwait advait. Which is, it's one, it's two. But to be able to look at it both at once, that's achinta veda veda tattva. Does that make sense? Yeah. So it's just a matter of, that's why those other philosophies come first, because they're easy. Like that. That they happen simultaneously, that's what's difficult.
But that we can conceive of the material energy separately from Krishna.
No, it's only our conception of it is separate. That is there, but it's not. You're sitting on this floor and not falling through because it's Krishna's potency who's holding you up. Right? And so there's a manifestation of Lakshmi as the floors, because floors hold things up. But it's manifesting Krishna's quality of support. So Krishna and his internal potency are interacting as support and those forms and activities of what manifests support. That's the Brahman platform. That it happens to be here in this form and you're involved with in your interaction, that's controlled by Paramatma. But that Krishna is a person, though he is that, is separate from that and enjoying with his devotees on the platform of love, that's Bhagavan. So they're simultaneously the same but different. But it's the mood that's different. Because here, Brahman is simply, it's just a generic quality. So depending upon how you relate to it, based on your attachments, then Krishna manifests. You know, all this is here because of how we look at things. If we looked at things differently, we'd be in the eternal Leela. You know, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, there's, you know, thousands of devotees with their veenas dancing and chanting the glories and like that, and the temple and all these things. We'd be in that. But we like to see, you know, bricks and blankets and stuff like that, you know, in this form, so that's what we're seeing. That's how Krishna interacts. Just to bring something out, why these things aren't being discussed is because this is the second year of a 3-year course. And so all this we discussed last year. Yeah, does that make sense? No. It's not that. It's just a matter of why I keep this succinct is because, you know, because this point comes up, you know, practically every day, you know, on that, you know, so it's some aspect of it, because we have a lot of problem with the Chinta Beta Beta Tattva, actually, that is simultaneously one and different, because we'll look at either the one or the different and emphasize one or the other, but that perfect balance, that they go on simultaneously. The gopis are talking to Braja Krishna, but complaining that he doesn't know how to behave with women properly, and the example is that he cut off Suparnita's nose. So they don't see any difference. But the point is how they want to relate to Krishna is through that particular conjugal affection, you know, that doesn't have, you know, it's not manifest through the formal social rules. Therefore, then he manifests as Krishna. But they don't see any difference between Krishna and Rama. It's the same person. Just one acts formally and one doesn't. You know, it's just like the wife doesn't see any difference between her husband, you know, sitting there, you know, on the, you know, high court bench like that and when he's at home. Just that's formal. And this is at home. It's the same person. But we tend to see the difference because of our conditioning of duality. So, oh, Vishnu, yeah, we don't. We're only into Krishna. But it's the same person. It's just the mood. The people at the court relate to him as the judge. He relates like that. If he's there, standing there with the lawyers, and his kid runs up to him, you know, and says, Daddy, Daddy, he turns into Daddy. Right, but the lawyers aren't going to say Daddy, Daddy. You know, they're going to be there dealing, you know, your excellent, you know, honor or whatever it is, you know. And so he manifests as the high court judge. Does that make sense? So means when you go to apply these into the practical situation, then there's so many considerations and all these social elements and all those come out. But we're not discussing that now. Right? We're discussing how to tell the difference between pure and alloyed devotional service and mixed devotional service and what's not devotional service at all. Because he's already made before the point that your occupation is not devotional service. Connecting it to the Lord, that's devotional service. Just so you have a job, it's not devotional service. Chanting Hare Krishna, that's devotional service. But having a job is not devotional service. You connect it to Krishna, then it becomes devotional service. So one has to be able to tell that difference, because if one can't tell the difference, one thinks just because I'm doing it, I'm automatically doing devotion, but he's not thinking of Krishna, so it doesn't become devotional. And so he's not getting satisfaction. And so the normal thing when you do something material for some time and it doesn't turn out the way you want to change it. So then you're thinking, I'm doing this service for Krishna. So, but you're not actually, because you're not telling the difference between what is the part for Krishna and what's not. Therefore, then you'll change to another occupation that you would have done anyway as a karmi. But now you'll consider that that didn't work connecting to Krishna. Now I'll do it not connected to Krishna. So it's just like putting illusion on top of illusion. And that, and then because you put illusion on illusion, the ego comes up more, and then you're more convinced that, no, I'm doing the right thing because the devotional approach didn't work. You know, if this is cutting too close to the, you know, ISKCON social bone here, you know, it's not meant, but it's reality. You know what I'm saying? Because if you look around here, there's a few brahmacharis, you know, so, clapping that they're still around, there still are brahmacharis, okay, you know what I'm saying, but the point is it's mostly grihasthas, so this kind of very cutting point, it's not found disturbing, because we're just dealing with the philosophical discern here. We're talking social application, then we'd be doing a class on mano. Because that's what it says. When you deal in those areas, then there's scriptures written specifically for that. Though the transcendental literatures deal all this, because when you have Krishna, you have everything. You know, that's why we pointed out in that first point here, Vishnu is the supreme principle in that. It's talking about how his loving relationships, all that, the very sweet aspect. It's pointing that out, even though it's establishing him as the personality of Godhead. To consider the name, etc., as different from the Lord is to consider the Lord and the name on a material level. This concept of duality is offensive. At the stage of Namabhas, one may hold this conception unconsciously from lack of knowledge or faith, but it is impossible to hold this conception at the stage of prema. This anartha can be removed by the mercy of the bona fide guru, who will guide the practitioner in sadhana bhakti, so that the Shuddha Nama, the pure name, is revealed. Right? So there's no other arrangement. It's simply by having by association, one becomes purified, then one is able to understand, or one is cultivating the knowledge, and through the practice, one is able to understand, or a combination. Yes?
This is like a variety of this offense of not accepting Vishnu as the Supreme.
Means, in other words, you're taking the demigods to be, their potency to be separate from Him.
Yes.
Only you're taking the name to be separate from Him, the potency of the name. I mean, Him and His name are non-different. The qualities that make the demigods who they are is also non-different from the Lord. Right? But it's an office. It's not Him as a person. Right.
The core of this offense is having this dualistic mentality.
Yes, duality. That's why it opened with that. Right? Vishnu is the supreme principle, not subject to the duality of the material world. That's how he opens. So that's your thesis. Right? Then the detail, you know, the second point of the logic is he is a form full of consciousness, knowledge, and that. You know, like that. Then after that, then he starts. Some people claim, now you're adding in the doubt, because now that we've established the Lord as who he is, then people will have a doubt, right? Right? You're going to logic. Then he's going to give all the examples and all those things like that. So the logic is just going to go in its natural form. Right? Right, you're saying the worship of Krishna is an essential part of the Varnashram system, but when we think about it, we just think of that as something to do. No, Varnashram actually means worship of Vishnu. That's why we say it. So you have Varnashram, which means worship of Vishnu. But if someone worships, you know, it means, but if someone doesn't worship, we call that Asuric Varnashram. Right? So the worship of Vishnu, that's Daiva Varnashram. Does that make sense? But otherwise, when we say Varnashram, we mean connected to Krishna. Yeah. Okay. By material speculation, one can bring about this concept of duality in the Lord, and it can become a serious offense which is difficult to remove. Thus, in the case of the Mayavadis, holding to this concept is an aparad. Right, so you have an anartha, then it turns into an aparad. Because when you take it and you profess it, then it becomes an aparad. Right, that's what I said. If let's say you have some bogus element that you are very convinced about, then that's bad. You get it's how you say it? You won't get any good benefit from it. But now if you take it and make it into a philosophy and preach it, then you get 100 times the reaction. Right, because now it's an aparad. Right, does that make sense? The Mayavadis claim that the impersonal Brahman is the supreme truth, without variety, character, or energies, without form or beauty, without change or activity, simply pure existence. For them, the name and the form of Vishnu are creations of Maya, the material energy of illusion. Strange, their words to exclaim all this are not illusion. You know what I'm saying? If there's only pure Brahman with no qualities, that means the spoken word is also illusion. So anything they're speaking is also illusion. Even if they're talking Mayavad philosophy, it's still an illusion. So somehow or another, it's interesting that only Vishnu gets, you know, the bad end of the deal here, while themselves are just as illusory, according to their philosophy. When a person can overcome illusion, then Vishnu simply merges into the impersonal Brahman, losing individual identity. Right? When you are, then he simply goes back. So he's just a manifestation for you because you are in this illusion that all this is here. Then when he's finished, he'll merge back. But the point is why would he come out and interact with you as Vishnu? So that by interacting, you could come to that platform of merging back into Brahman. Why would he do that? Just it was Thursday afternoon, nothing to do, he was bored. You know, is of his kindness. So the point is just that he's doing that indicates that there's a quality. And though they say there's no quality. So why would Brahman do that? If Brahman could do that, that, as we said before, that means there's the ability to do that, which is qualities. So this idea of nirguna Brahman is totally bogus. There is no such thing. Right? Impersonal manifestation, that we'll say is completely there. It's bona fide. But it's not the highest. Bhagavan is the highest. But the Mayavadi concept, the philosophy, that's just absolutely bogus, completely. The only good thing about it is they try to base it on scripture. So they accept the authority of the Veda. That's the good thing about them, as opposed to a Buddhist. But philosophically, they're exactly the same. There isn't any difference. This is all simply bad logic, based on atheism, to claim that the supreme truth is without all inconceivable transcendental energies, or is unable to possess character, is madness. There may be some confusion of what to call the supreme truth, Brahman or Vishnu, but in either case, the highest realization must be God with energies and personality. Right? What you want to call him, that doesn't matter. But the point is he is a person with energies in a person. Person with energies. Right? So that's the highest understanding. That is the Vedic conclusion. Thus, one must avoid the offense of thinking materially that Vishnu and his name, form, etc. are different, and of thinking that other living entities, such as the demigods, have an existence separate from Vishnu. In other words, thinking that something's separate from the Lord, that's the offense. Right? But one has to know how to apply that. You know what I'm saying? It's not sentiment. It's his potency is everything. Right? So that's what makes the demigod special. Right? And because he's non-different from the name, that's because the name is in connection with his personality. Right? Because when we say the name here, means it is. Brahman is non-different, but we're not talking about those names. You know, we're not talking about secondary names, we're talking about the primary names. Yes.
This paragraph is a synthesis.
Yes. And then, conclusion? To summarize. Yeah, you understand? See? That's what I'm saying. They work. The acharyas work by this panchanga nyaya. It's just the only way to present it. It means the Western, when you talk logic, then they use three. They're using all five, but they use three. They just don't know how to divide it up like that. But it's just the way logic works. You have to present something, then defeat all the arguments, and then reestablish your position. To summarize, whoever is solely devoted to Krishna simply worships Krishna and gives up all other worship. He does not criticize. So giving up all of the worship doesn't mean that you don't use the mediums of worship. Right? Just like the tantric system of using mantra and ritual is that in relationship to Vishnu, which is sattvika tantra. That's what we call pancharatra. You understand? So the Vedic systems of worship aren't given up. It's that they're only seen in connection with the Lord. Because otherwise we say, whoever is solely devoted to Krishna simply worships Krishna and gives up all other worship. So we say, oh, see here, we don't have to follow the rules, we give up all the worship, but then how are you going to worship Krishna? How are you going to express the worship? That's what Shastra defines. What are the ways you can worship the Lord? But materialists use these worships and apply them to entities other than the Lord for purposes other than pleasing the Lord. It's not the other way around. It's not that, oh, we're taking these and then we're somehow or another just adding Krishna to it. No. That's how we're perceiving it. No, we're recognizing that Krishna already is there. You know what I'm saying? I'm making money, I have my family, but I'm adding Krishna to that. No, it's that what you're looking at is only Krishna anyway. You know, the wifeness of your wife, the childness of your child, you know, the security of your home, you know, the economic power of your money, all that's Krishna anyway. But now we're recognizing it by starting to see the result connected to Krishna. Right, does that make sense? So the point is the Pancharatrik systems, the Vedic systems, the Bhagavat systems, those stay in place. This idea, oh, we don't have to follow anything. No, how do you express it then? Yes.
Now, these three systems are like three visions. These three types of systems are like three types of vision.
These three kinds allow three kinds of vision. Technically, no. Means they deal with your varieties of realization, you could say. You know, in other words, the Bhagavat is just directly out of affection worshipping the Lord. But the point is what does Mother Yashoda do for Krishna? Right? How does the day start? He wakes him. Okay, so Pancharatra is simply the formalization of Bhagavat. So what's the first thing you do in the morning for the deity? You wake the deity. Okay. Now what's the next thing Mother Yashoda is going to do? Bathes him, dresses him, and feeds him. Okay, now in the deity worship, what's the next thing you do? Like that. So like that, the Pancharatra is only establishing in a formal way what goes on in the Bhagavad platform. So there's actually no difference between them. And the Vedic is simply applying that same principle, but instead of the direct activities, to all the supporting activities, the social, economic, the senses, all those aspects. Because why does she have to wake him? Right? He's sleeping, but what is he going to do when he wakes up? Why would there be a manifestation of his waking up? Why is there Mother Yashoda? Pastimes. So that means there's other people there. So that means there's social elements. So the social element is, so what does the Shastra say about waking up? When do you wake up?
Early morning.
Yeah, early morning. So Mother Yashoda wakes him up early morning. So in other words, the Shastras document all the social elements, the social environment that Krishna likes to perform his pastimes in. Does that make sense? Because, you know, you can't say, well, you know, how is it going to work? How socially involved can Krishna get, you know, in interaction if everybody's saying, you know, Mother Yashoda is saying, no, Krishna said you got to wake him up at this time. Like that. And Krishna said you have to bathe him and dress him like this and feed him like this. And everybody's just talking about what Krishna said you should do. What will be the interaction between all the Brajbasis and Krishna? Natural, spontaneous? No, very formal. He's God and that's it. You know what I'm saying? So that's called Vaikuntha. Right? So now for him to have these spontaneous pastimes means the authority has to be seemingly coming from somewhere else. Right, Vaikuntha, if you do this in the Shastra because God, you know, gave this and that's why we're following it. But here it's that we're just villagers. We take care of cows. So where does the authority come from? If Krishna's going to be part of that, it can't come from that he said it. It has to come from the scriptures. You understand? So in the spiritual world, the scriptures are referred to because it establishes the environments to serve Krishna. Right? But those forms that are described, that's not what they're attached to. What they're attached to is the service. Right? Does that make sense? If it wasn't a thing that unmarried girls, you know, in that region were worshipping Katyayani, then would we have the pastime of Krishna stealing the clothes of the gopis? No. Okay. If it was okay that, you know, any lady, you know, hung out with anybody at any time, would we have the rasa dance at night?
Would it be so special?
Yeah, it wouldn't be so special because anything can go on anywhere. You know what I'm saying? Like dogs, they're running around here. It's Kartik, right? You know, so you have one lady dog and there's, you know, 10, 15, you know, male dogs running behind. So is it special? No. Nobody even looks. Nobody cares. Does that make sense? You know, the only advantage is one might think, oh, it's Kartik. You know, like that, you know. Does that make sense? So that's the idea, is that there's no difference. The Vedic establishes the social environment that Krishna likes to perform his pastimes in. You know what I'm saying? So the cowherd boys are taking the cows out. That's their occupation, but they're remembering Krishna. So therefore, whatever your occupation is, you remember Krishna. It's the same principle. Detail is specific. You know, may have its application, but the principle is always the same. That's why it also said he's the supreme principle. That means when it comes to principle, it's always him. Right? Vishnu is the supreme principle. That means everything is him, not subject to the duality of the material world. That's the secondary point, is that the duality that comes up in the material world where we don't see the principle, or we don't see the connection, we don't see the connection between the principle and detail. We separate them. Or we separate the principle from Krishna. Or the detail from Krishna. That only comes up in the material world. It doesn't come up in the spiritual world. Yes?
I like your analogy with the deities. And the waking them up, bathing them, dressing them, feeding them. And it works well with Mother Yasoda and, say, Damodar. But some of us have Radha Krishna deity, so how does that work with Radha Krishna? We're waking them, but who are, you know, what kind of relationship do we have that we're waking Krishna?
For us, generally it's called Lakshmi Narayan.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, because otherwise so, there's the Mangal Artik that we know, where you get up, wake them, Radha and Krishna up, they sit together and they offer an artik. That's done by the gopis out in the forest after they wake up after the rasa dance. That's where the Mangal artik goes. Mother Yashoda doesn't have a Mangal artik. You know what I'm saying? It's just that here we discuss more in line with, you know, Mother Yashoda and the cowherd boys. That makes sense. It works better. You get less, what do you call them? So it comes to mind, or clinkers, you know? Clinker. It's when you heat iron or metal, then it separates into the pure metal and all the alloys. Right? And when you separate it off, then the alloys, when they harden, one of the slangs you can call them is clinkers. You know, a big chunk of metal that has no real purpose. So to avoid the attraction to the slag, you know, but we're talking about the pure metal, then you don't give examples that will catch in the mind unless it's something to do that. Does that make sense? So, more times you hear about Mother Yashoda than the gopis. Occasionally that'll come up. You know, like that. You know, parental rasa, everyone can relate to it because everybody has a mother. Not necessarily everyone can relate to conjugal because not necessarily everyone's very successful at it. So, you know, so no one will feel bad. You stick to Mother Yashoda and okay, you know, unless of course, you know, you had a nightmare mom, then, you know, of course you can have social issues there. But generally you have less people that had nightmare moms but have nightmare conjugal lives. So. Does that make sense? Like that. to summarize, how whoever is solely devoted to Krishna simply worships Krishna and gives up all other worship, right? Not methods of worship, but who you're worshiping. He does not criticize the demigods or the scriptures which support the worship of the demigods, but respects the demigods as the servants of Krishna. So we don't have any problem that these things are mentioned, because we understand that's mentioned for someone whose consciousness is lower and can't appreciate the Supreme. So at least they're following the Vedic system, which all you have to do is change Krishna. You know, I mean, the worship from the demigod to Krishna. They already have guru, they follow shastra, they have regulation and sadhana, you know, they follow all the social customs and dealing, the proper grihasthas. The only thing wrong is Krishna's not there. So that's what he's saying. Gives up all other worship. The worship itself isn't given up. The method of worship's not given. It's who you're worshiping. Just like if you connect your money to Krishna, you don't give up the money. You don't give up the business, right? I'm doing business, I make money, it's for myself. Now, I'm going to give it to Krishna, so therefore I don't make money because that's all Maya. No, it stays the same. So worship stays the same. Pancharatra stays the same. The systems stay the same, but because it's only Vishnu, it's called Pancharatra. Right? If it's not Vishnu, then it's, you know, other tantras. Does that make sense? The social things go on exactly the same, but you add Vishnu, Krishna is exclusively there rather than others. You greet people, right? But the others, you're greeting people because, you know, I'm who I am, I'm this body and I'm greeting your body, right? And we make this, you know, sociological thing by touching hands, and that somehow or another makes it where, you know, there's more of a trust and everything like that. If I really didn't trust you, I wouldn't want to touch your hand, because God only knows where that hand's been. Or I don't know what you'll do once you grab mine, you know. You might stab me in the back, so many things like that. So there must be that kind of show of trust like that. But here is a greeting Vaishnavas who are servants of the Lord. So the greeting is in connection with the devotees and the Lord. So the social custom doesn't change. Some scriptures may establish demigods as supreme to establish belief in different categories of human beings in order to raise them through regulation to the point of coming to faith in Krishna and bhakti, right? Because it says after many, many lifetimes. So the point is if they're following the process at some point. But we have this, we the Gaudiyas, you know, and as preachers then have this, rather than letting them push the car for millions of lifetimes till it finally starts, and we come in and jump start it, right? So it's we just try to speed up the process from millions of lifetimes to one. Yeah, you know, so like that. The true Vaishnava will see the function of the demigods in their respective scriptures in proper perspective. That's why then when you're dealing with a Hindu, it's not that you throw out all that, it's all nonsense. No, worship is kept, but the problem is you don't have to worship the demigods. You now do the worship and just worship Krishna. But we'll throw out everything, because we can't distinguish between the worship of Krishna and the medium through which you worship. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? McDonald's makes fries. They're made out of potatoes. So now if we're going to cook for Krishna, we can't use potatoes because those are mine. Right? Good logic, right? Right? So that's what we do when we come to worship. We just worship Krishna. So therefore, no samskars, no this, that. That was the first thing he mentioned, was he does the samskars. Right? In other words, in all the samskars from insemination to funeral rites, Krishna should be worshipped. Criticism of Krishna's servants, the demigods, is also offensive, right? So just like we don't criticize the devotees, we don't criticize the demigods, we don't criticize the scriptures that seemingly are in support of the demigods. They say Indra is supreme, but supreme in his place. You know, it's just like the kid, you know, out in the sandbox is the supreme, right? You know, He says what will be made. He says what shovel will be used. He says whether the sand will be dry or wet. You know, he says whether it will be on the ground or flying in the air. You know, like that. So he's supreme in the sandbox. But when his mother comes along and tells him to get out of the sandbox, it's time for, you know, breakfast, then, you know, his supremacy suddenly comes to an end. Right? So that's how he's talking about the demigods. In his position as king of the universe, Indra is supreme, because there isn't another king. But it's not that the king, there's no one above kings, because whenever you have a king, who's above kings? God, Brahmins, right? So therefore, above Indra is Brihaspati and the Prajapatis, who are all Brahmins, right? Brahma is the head of all the Brahmins, is above. Narad Muni, all the sages, Shiva, right? But who's above the Brahmins, right? Brahman, because Brahman, Brahmana means one who worships Brahman. And the supreme Brahman is Krishna, the personality of Godhead. So therefore, to have a king and to say he's supreme doesn't mean that these other aspects are there, but a less intelligent person thinks that, oh, they're the top and there's no one above them. Right? So that concept is actually a material concept, where the person who's in charge has to be on top of everything. The normal thing is, no, he manages, but he has people above him. Like that. Yes.
What is that Brahman that the Brahmins
worship? No, Brahmana means one who worships Brahman, yeah, which means transcendence. So now, according to the level of realization, they'll either understand Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan. Like that. Does that make sense? You know, and for some of them, it might even mean they follow all the rules and regulations of the Shastra, so they're situated in goodness, and this way they're Brahmana. But technically, they're indirectly worshipping Brahman, because they're worshipping through the material presentation, that materialistic, seemingly material presentation of the scriptures. They're not actually getting to the essence, which is the Lord. Does that make sense?
If I understand correctly, that you were mentioning the samskaras, that we're not throwing out the demigods, that actually they play a part in the rituals of a Vaishnava?
Yeah.
So, and can you give an example of that?
Let's say, the first mantra in the wedding that the husband says, that the groom says in connection with the bride, is, this bride belongs to Vishnu. Right? And so everything that's there, all the mantras that are being chanted, is all about how Krishna is actually the attractive cause. He's Madan. So the whole universe is attractive because Krishna has entered it. Because why is he marrying? Why is the groom interested in marrying the bride? Right? I mean, of course, she's, you know, from a, you know, billionaire family, and he's, you know, an opportunist. So that's why he's marrying her, right? So he's, you know, but that means he thinks the money's there. But it's because he thinks she's beautiful, she's attractive. But it's actually the one who's actually attractive is Vishnu, right? And then you have this mantra. It's really not understood. The Kama Stuti. That kama means desire. And so it starts, it goes through, you know, who is loving who, where does this love come from? Love comes from love goes back to love, you know, through love, then we have a relationship. You know, very nice, romantic and everything, but the point is the principle of love that's coming from the Lord. And we're taking the forms of the masculine and the feminine forms, which are temporary, it's not real, that someone acts as a man or acts as a woman. That's actually the Lord's potencies. So that love is coming through and coming back, but we're not recognizing it, then we're getting no spiritual benefit. We're just thinking it's the bodies are attracted and therefore the love. It's actually Krishna's potencies. So understanding that, it's Krishna who's creating that. So I've just given the first like five mantras of the wedding. Does that make sense?
Right. Rupa Goswami, somewhere it says the Vaishnavas, they can approach Ganesh to remove obstacles. I was thinking more along the lines of how the demigods enter into the Vedic or the Pancharatra system.
Nah, they're not really there. Because no. How do you approach Ganesh? You have to go through the spiritual master. You know, what is Ganesh? You know, what do you have? What's your relationship with Ganesh? Why he should listen to you? He's a big guy. You know, he removes all the obstacles of the whole universe. So what's he keeps the Sringadev's feet on his head? That's how he's able to do it. So what do you got to do with him? No, no, I'm just asking. You understand the point? So in other words, it's through the spiritual master.
Right.
So the point is whatever's there is through the spiritual master.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're doing these rituals, then you're starting with, the first thing in a ritual is God stopping it, which is installing Ganesh in the pot and worshipping the pot. So that ritual is performed. But we put Vishwakshena, we put the spiritual master, like this. So it always comes back. The principle is there. In other words, Ganesh is the person that represents that obstacles are removed. But for us, then within the Pancharatric system, Ganesh is not really important. It's the principle. Like that. Does that make sense? So that's the point. It's just like, let's say, in the wedding, who gives away the girl? Okay, let's say there is no father. Who gives away the girl? Huh? Brother. But, I mean, what's the principle? Who do you choose? Right? Her little five-year-old brother walks her down the aisle. Someone who protects, so it's the fatherly position. So there's the natural inherent. Since you're dealing with a biological function here, then the one who is the natural, you know, previous cause of one's being in that position to get married would be the natural person, right? The biological father would be the natural one who would be wanting to see that, you know, the growing up is there, the proper arrangements and all that. But if he's not there, then someone else in the position of father does it. Does that make sense? So it's the same with that, with Ganesh. It's a principle.
Since we're on this Ramachandra, externally it appears that he, you know, there was some worship of Shiva going on.
He's a king.
Right, so how does that work?
He's a king. So Vishnu's going to worship himself? Is that going to be fun? Let's try another example. Whose shoes is Krishna carrying on his head, you know, as a very small baby?
None.
Okay, now that's fun. Now, would he want to walk around with his own shoes on his head? No, those are dirty. They're his shoes, right? It's just like you have prasad and you have bhog. Can bhog touch prasad? No. Right, because prasad's pure to us, but to Krishna, that's what he's already eaten. So bhog is what he's not eaten, so they shouldn't touch. You know what I'm saying? So, what's going to be the fun of worshipping himself?
So that's confusing. How are they worshipping Shiva?
Because it's the pastime, you worship someone else who's junior. Nityananda, who is first? Nityananda or Advaita? I mean, as far as who's first? Balaram or Mahavishnu? Balaram. But in the pastime, who's the senior? Okay. Who's the first? Krishna or Balaram? But who's senior? So that's the fun. Is that, in other words, you're God, so doing all those things that makes it look as if you're not, those are fun. You know, it's like, I think it was Louis XIV, you know, him and his queen and his close entourage used to like to dress up as villagers, you know, at Versailles, of course, you know, and frolic through the fields there like they're just ordinary people. They would do that for fun. You know, because, you know, it's obvious. You don't have to establish that you're the emperor like that. So it's fun to be ordinary. So it's like, you know, ordinary people do this, therefore it's fun to do that. That's the meaning of Bhagavan. Because the problem is you're having a problem in answering that he's Paramatma. You know, he's the Supreme, he's Godhead, he's the Absolute. Those are defined because that's his position. But as Bhagavan, that's not the important point. Unless someone has to combine the two, that's Lakshmi Narayan. Therefore, we made that statement. Does that make sense? When we worship, Prabhupada said, when we're worshiping Lakshmi Narayan. It's Radha and Krishna, but they have to interact with us as Lakshmi Narayan because that's how we deal with them. The only reason we're there at Mangalartics is we're supposed to be. But the gopis, when they have Mangalartic, they want to be there. So that's why it's Radha and Krishna.
Couldn't Ram just as easily worship Narayan?
No, his father does that. I mean, what's the problem if you worship Shiva? Why do you have a problem with it?
Because it's confusing.
Why is it confusing? It's his pastime.
Well,
confusing is fun. You know what I'm saying? Why do people like to go to masquerade parties or Halloween or, right? You know, because people don't, you know, you've always wanted to be, you know, Flash, but you can do that on that day. You know what I'm saying? So it's fun. The point is why does the Lord have his pastimes? To interact with his devotees. So here also, then he's interacting with Lord Shiva. And basically he's telling him that he's going to, you know, despite Ravana being his disciple and being his devotee, he's going to kill him anyway. So don't mind. The point is he's having pastimes. He does what he likes. That's what makes him. That's why he's so comfortable in Braj. He can do anything. He can't do just anything in Vaikuntha. So in Vaikuntha, he would never do that.
But Ram is the pillar of Dharma. He's showing that.
Dharma, kings worship Shiva. So the point is this, but what is it that he's doing? He's the pillar of Dharma. Is it that the Dharma's done, or it's the taste of being dharmic?
Well, he's showing the path of an ideal king.
No, he's showing the element, he's tasting what it means to be fully absorbed in just that rasa. Because otherwise, someone like Prithu Maharaj, now that is the Shaktivesha avatar of a king. You know, or Ambarish Maharaj. This is just purely kings. Because does a king sit out in the forest and lament for 9 months that someone stole his wife? Is that what a king does? You know what I'm saying? You read in the histories, kings do it. I mean, what Santanu, he really, you know, had a problem when Ganga Devi left. You know what I'm saying? Because of the mode of passion, they taste that. But he's tasting it all in relationship with his devotees. Well, they're just under the modes of nature. You know what I'm saying?
That's part of the undoing of Ravana, that he stole Sita.
Yeah. But the point is in that situation, Ram can taste the Vipalamba aspect of Swakiya Rasa. Otherwise, if God and Lakshmi, right? Narayan and Lakshmi, can they be separated? No, because they're God. So how do you taste Vipalamba? Therefore, you perform a pastime as if you're human. Because Lakshmi and Narayan aren't human. They're God. But Ram is acting as a human. Perfect human, but therefore he can taste separation from his wife. Because otherwise, you can taste the parakia, vipralamba, and Vrindavan. Right? And you can partially taste that in Dwarka, because, you know, he goes every day out to the assembly and comes back, or he goes out on some campaign, or he goes to Dwarka. You know? But it's not so intense, because you know it's there, it's regular, it's ordinary, and he's back. It's after some time. But, you know, it's part of duty. But here it's just gone. Don't know where she is. Stolen. So you can taste the full, absolute vipralamba within Swakia. That's what's going on. That him establishing Dharma and all that, that comes as a side.
Vaishnava, I asked Aram Bhakta, I asked this question to, he came back with, they're worshipping Shiva like Guru.
Okay, that's nice. But now, if you want to have, if you want to progress nicely in these kind of assemblies, then you go, raise your hand and go, I once talked to a Ram Bhakta, and I asked him about this pastime of Shiva, you know, Ram worshipping Shiva, and he said that that's like he's worshipping Guru and showing how the kings always worship Guru and stuff like that. So what is the Gaudiya perspective?
I have no idea.
No, I'm just saying, that would be a real question.
Oh, I see.
So how you approached it then wouldn't be proper. Because then after saying all this, then you say that. That's right. Like after the three-hour talk on the train with a Hindu. And then he goes, yes, I read Gita when I used to have and this and that.
I didn't remember it until just a few minutes ago.
Okay. But that's the way to approach it. Because the point is that those things are there because Shiva's there. That's what they do. But the point is now, whether someone's seeing as Vaishnavanam Yata Shambhu, or they're seeing him as the Supreme, or they're seeing him as a demigod, someone else is Supreme, but the point is they're worshipping there. But the thing is for us, we have that worship, but he's, you know, who controls the Dham, who protects the Dham. So that's our only connection. That's it. Nothing more. You know, so we don't use any different method. We use the same methods that we use within our Pancharatrik system to worship him. We don't use Shaiva Tantra for that.
So the demigods are present in the Pancharatrik system in some form.
But what's the, no? But what is the point? Like Gopeshwar Mahadev and Ganesh, and there's 33 million. So if you talk about 33 million and two are present, can you say the demigods are present? Yeah, it's like, you know, we're in an airport, right? You know, the thing is packed like that. They just, you know, the volcano has just exploded in, you know, Sweden somewhere. And everybody's backed up. No flights are going. And there's tens of thousands of people. And there's one American there. Then can we say, wow, there's Americans in the airport? You know, that would not be the statement you'd say. Does that make sense? Yeah. So we've gotten two mentioned out of 33 million. So they're very specific because Ganesh is a devotee of Nisringadev. It's said he keeps, as you know, he has the tumuli, those bumps on his head. He keeps the lotus feet of the Lord there. Right? That's why he takes the form of the North Indian elephant because the South Indian elephant doesn't have those bumps. Right? So where is he going to put the feet? Right? And Ganesh, then he's Vishrakshana, who's the main devotee of when you're doing Vishnu worship like that, then Vishrakshana, Garuda, Hanuman, they're there. They're the gurus. You know, so it's the same principle of guru. Everything has to go through them. You know, so it's the standard Pancharatrik worship, but it's Vishrakshana, because Ganesh is this expansion of Vishrakshana. He's the commander-in-chief of the Vaikuntha army. Right? So him, Garuda, they're always there. Like when you do Pancharatrik worship, you know, in the Vaikuntha mood, like, you know, Shris and others, then they do everything through Vishrakshana. They take off all the garlands of the deity, they give it to Vishrakshana. And then when they're doing the worship, and then through their, with their blessings, then they worship. So they're gurus. So there's Vishrakshana, there's Lakshmi, and there's like that. So then you have your gurus before that. So it's the same. You know, they're worshipped in that mood like previous acharya. Does that work? So both of them have that element of being Vaishnavas, you know, and, you know, on an advanced level, and of being seen in the position of guru. Indra's not exactly seen as guru. He's superior, you know, to these others. But these two are like guru. Is that okay? Does that work better? So yes, two demigods are mentioned.
Actually, all the demigods are worshiping Vishnu, so they are
all
present.
Yeah, that's true, also. Because they're all the arms of Vishnu, so therefore, then they're present like that. That's it, but he's discussing directly, you know. Yeah, I mean, the separation comes because, see, because by tendency, we being people will always separate things into that. We'll always do that. The problem comes is if we do it in illusion, then it doesn't come out right. But that we do this, like devotees would write Prabhupada. This devotee, he's so impersonal, you know, he did this, he did that. And Prabhupada's point is no, it's because he's a person, he did this and he did that. So there's no such thing as, because he's impersonal, he does, no, because impersonal doesn't do anything. You know, just, you know, there's an existence there. You know? I know he's here, the president's here somewhere. You know, no, it's, he did something because he's a person. He has desires and needs and, you know, character and all these things. That's why he did it. So it's, he's a person. So his point is this, there's no such thing as that impersonal aspect. It's, even the impersonal is personal. Does that work? Oh, we're already over time. Okay. Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Jai Srila Prabhupada ki Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki Jai Nitai Gaurav Devanandi.